do anticipate very shortly getting additional doses. And as we get additional doses, we're going to stay aligned with CDC, and we'll move into what's being called wave two, and we'll be able again to expand our ability to serve more people who are at higher risk for monkeypox and want to go ahead and get vaccinated.
That's LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer answering questions about the vaccine for monkeypox. LA County has so far received more than 7,000 doses from the federal government and expects to get more in the coming weeks. But right now, the county is making vaccines available by invitation only, mainly to those who've been exposed to a case already verified by the Public Health Department. Monkeypox is way less transmissible than COVID-19 and highly treatable, but with the pandemic still going on and transmission of the BA.5 variant on the rise, is our public health system ready to fight a second virus? Joining me now is Dr. Sahir Khan, an infectious disease specialist with Keck Medicine of USC. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Khan. Let's start off broad brush. What is monkeypox and how worried should people be?
So, monkeypox is a virus related to smallpox. It's was commonly found in parts of sub-Saharan Africa previously. This current outbreak is really becoming worldwide. I think people should be less concerned about this generally than, let's say, COVID-19. This is not going to be something that's going to end up with, 100 or a million Americans dying of this virus. It's far less fatal. And actually, this monkeypox strain seems to be less fatal than some of the prior strains in Africa. And it doesn't spread through the air as readily as with COVID-19. So I think it's less of a concern broadly than COVID-19. But certainly, depending on your risk level, it is something to be aware of.
Right. And this is like flu-like symptoms generally and a rash that can turn into blisters. We know there were 70 confirmed cases of the virus here in LA County as of yesterday evening. What's the state of the virus then? How fast is it spreading? Is that a number that concerns you?
Part of the challenge with an early stage of an epidemic like this is the testing took some time to ramp up. So it's likely that there are a lot of cases out there that have, not yet been confirmed or where, testing was not as accessible. So, the numbers of confirmed cases are likely, there's many more out there that in addition.
Right.
But I do think that, there's different levels of, not everybody gets the classical rash. Some people just get flu-like symptoms. Some people can be largely asymptomatic. So, I don't think we have any evidence that it's becoming a broad-based population disease where, a significant proportion of the population has gotten it.
Right. And do you have to have the sores to spread it then, or can you spread it in other ways?
So generally, we believe at this point that it's spread through close contact, skin to skin, sexual contact, and secretions like saliva and kissing. And the sores certainly spread it much more readily. If you're largely asymptomatic or you just have a flu-like illness, we think you're less likely to spread it. I can't say that the risk is zero. We're still learning a lot about this virus, but it does appear to spread more readily through skin lesions.
Got it. And I know a lot of the focus so far has been on the LGBT community, but we know that viruses do not stay put in one community for very long. Are there signs that it is beginning to spread more widely?
I would compare this to sort of early stage of HIV/AIDS epidemic where, it may start in one community and certainly some of the initial sort of super spreader events were in the LGBTQ community. But this, anybody can get monkeypox, and it really, it's not restricted to any one community. I think, we still see most of the cases, I think, in the LGBTQ community, but certainly we've seen cases outside of that, and certainly anyone can get this virus. The virus itself doesn't discriminate.
Well, as we said, it is treatable and it's not as highly contagious as COVID-19. And yet we are seeing cases go up. Do you see it as containable or do you think this is something that would be circulating for a while?
You know, I see this as something that will likely stay in the human population to some extent as a largely sexually transmitted disease, but I don't see this as achieving the sort of numbers in the population that when you look at other sexually transmitted diseases like, you know, HIV, syphilis, herpes, you know, I don't see it becoming like that. I see it, it being sort of a relatively uncommon disease, but I don't think we're going to eliminate it from the human population.
All right, well, let's talk about vaccines. We've heard from Dr. Ferrer that the supply is extremely low. When do you anticipate more vaccines and who's eligible now?
So right now, you need to essentially be a close contact of a confirmed case. And as I mentioned with the testing before, this is somewhat problematic because that means your close contact who is a suspected case has to have actually had confirmatory testing that was positive. So you know, a lot of people who may be at risk are not yet eligible. We're trying to expand it to where sort of anybody who thinks, you know, they may have been in contact with it, with this, even a suspected case, could potentially come in and get it. It's not at that point yet. And I mean, as far as the ramping up, I mean, the federal government is mostly ramping up the production and distribution. I don't have any specific, you know, insight, but all yeah. all of their messaging is that they are rapidly ramping this up and it should be available soon to all at-risk people.
Well, you know, Dr. Khan, this all comes as we're still trying to fend off BA5, the latest strain in this relentless fight against COVID-19. Was our public health system prepared for this new virus, or do you think the pandemic has been such a strain on our systems that we've, you know, left some holes there? We haven't had time to mobilize using lessons we might have learned from the past couple of years.
Well, I think there's been a lot of challenges in our public health system. Some of them are structural, pre-existing COVID. We have a very decentralized system, like healthcare system in general. And, you know, there was some trouble with COVID getting full buy-in from the population. I think some of those same challenges here, but I will say that in general, it's difficult to keep up with a new virus, and ramp up distribution and production rapidly. I think actually we're in a better place now than we were at the beginning of COVID because of learning from our experience with COVID. I do think there is some level in the population of just fatigue where, you know, people understandably are tired of hearing about all the risks to their health and it creates anxiety. But you know, unfortunately, with the movement of people and these viruses are going to just become more and more common. And so public health issues like this are never going away.
All right. Well, a little good news there. Dr. Sahir Khan, thank you so much. He's an infectious disease specialist with Keck Medicine of USC.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we talked to a photographer and cowgirl about the nation's only all-black touring rodeo, which is making a swing through the city of industry this weekend. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brandt. When you hear the word cowboy, what kind of images come to mind? Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven? Brooks and Dunn doing the boot scootin' boogie? Well, a new book reveals the side of cowboy culture maybe you haven't imagined, a community of black cowboys in the Bay Area. For over a decade, Gabriella Hasbun has been photographing cowboys and girls at the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo. In her new book, The New Black West, Photographs from America's Only Touring Black Rodeo, she tells the stories of cowgirls like 19-year-old KK Brinson, who's been competing since she was 13. Joining us now is KK. Hey there.
Hello. How are you?
Great. We also have with us photographer and author Gabriella Haspen. Hey, Gabby.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing well and so excited to talk to you both. KK, I want to start with you. Can you take us back to the first time you got on a horse?
The first time I got on a horse, I was at the age of 9. It was a weird feeling at first. I was a little skeptical about it. I was on this big red mare, and she was a sorrel horse, which is a red horse. That's their color. And I think I was a little frightened by her size at the time because she was a little taller than the other horses that were around, but I got used to her over a week. So,
and was it an immediate passion of yours? Like, when did you realize this was something you wanted to pursue?
I think after a year of not riding, and I came back to a camp in Daly City, California. I did it for 2 weeks, and someone saw a spark in my eyes and ended up giving me a horse. So
that's incredible. Yeah. So there's a big leap though from riding horses at summer camp or casually to competing. How did you make that leap?
Well, from the age to 9 to, I want to say maybe 11, I ended up joining this group called Spurred Up. They used to get city kids in and bring them to the country. And we trained with a man named Don Clark. And my experience with that was I first started with team pitting. It had something to do with cattle. And then when I turned 13, I was able to compete in my first rodeo, which was Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo.
That's so cool. And I mentioned you're competing this weekend at the Bill Pickett Invitational in the City of Industry. You were in Oakland last weekend. I understand you'll be doing barrel racing, which I have to admit I dabbled in as a kid as well. It's hard. Explain to folks what barrel racing is. What's the event?
So the event is that you have 3 barrels in a triangle shape. The 2 barrels sit from 90 feet and the third sits in between 100 feet, depending on the arena size. And you have the choice of going to the left or right first. And basically you would go outside of the barrel. You're trying to beat a clock to see who has the fastest time on the horse. And that's how it is.
Do you see people falling off a lot?
Oh, I fell off before.
Yeah. That's what I remember about trying it.
I fell off a couple of times, but still got on.
That's great. All right. So, Gabby, talk to us about when you discovered this pocket of Black cowboys in the Bay.
Yeah, this was like way back in 2007. My neighbor just wanted to go out there to find authentic fried catfish. She is from Arkansas. Sadly, she passed away this year, but she was like, Gabby, grab your camera. I'm taking you to the rodeo. We're going to go find authentic, you know, fried catfish. Cause she, you know, she's a foodie as every Bay Area person is. So literally food dragged us out to the Bill Pickett. And I was just enamored from day one. I'd never really been around horses and just kind of fell in love.
That's so amazing. And these pictures are really stunning. Before we get into that, though, you know, Hollywood movies and sort of our basic understanding often paint cowboys as white people. But there is a rich history of this community being part of the sort of rodeo culture, right? This isn't new.
At
all.
No, it's not new. It's just there's been a hole in the media where no one has really been covering the cowboys, you know, and the rodeos. But there's other Black rodeos happening around the country. They're just not touring rodeos.
So you go out there for the catfish and you have your camera. Was it something that you knew you wanted to keep following? Because this is obviously an annual event.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first year I went, I took horrible pictures. The second year I went, I took my big medium format camera and just kind of stayed behind the scenes mostly. And I just really love taking pictures of participants and their horses, what they were wearing. Everything was amazing. And then just the fact that there's this culture, this Black community just hidden out here in the hills of the East Bay just kind of blew my mind, because it is like one of the like safest, warmest, like fun community I've met in a long time. It's really the people that ended up like bringing me back every year, just because meeting them was so special.
All right. Well, some of the photos in your book focus, a lot of them, on the style of the riders and the folks who come to the rodeo. The riders especially are often wearing crisp cotton shirts. A lot of them have customized belt buckles and boots, designer saddles in some cases. Talk about the importance of fashion. You write in the beginning of the book that these young riders are, quote, forging something new in the collision of classic and contemporary.
I never expected to see cool kids like KK, honestly, like riding horses. I thought, oh, maybe this is for introverts or just like, you know, not cool kids. And these were all cool kids. Ask KK, she dresses, she's one of the most fashionable people at the rodeo. She's always wearing something amazing. And I mean, it's everything from the snakeskin boots that like Leroy, who's cow, who's a bull rider and retired cowboy, he will go to Tijuana to buy these amazing snakeskin boots. People are also obsessed with like Louis Vuitton. So Pat Davis, he owns a barbecue joint here in Berkeley. And, you know, he had a custom Louis Vuitton saddle made for his horse, Hercules. So it's just really personalized.
So the horse is wearing nicer stuff than I am.
Yeah, exactly.
KK, talk about it. I mean, you are known for amazing, colorful fashion. How important is what you're wearing to you when you're competing?
It's just kind of like a natural thing for me. You know, outside of horses, I still have to dress nice. It's very important to me. Like, even if I have a good run, they'll still remember me. If I have a bad run, they'll still remember me. I just like to dress nice and like a little flashy, you know?
Yeah. What are you wearing this weekend?
Like a salmon pink. And then I have like this white tack set that has fringe and bling on it. I wore it this past weekend. So, well, awesome. It's a little basic, but it's not too flashy.
All right. Gabby, one photo in your book shows a cowboy riding with a version of the African-American flag, which is sort of like an American flag with red and green and black. Other photos show young cowgirls dressed in red and green and black chaps. Can you talk about what you've learned about the pride that comes with being part of this tradition for this community?
This specific event is all about Black pride and Black heritage, and they make the Bill Pickett folks really do an amazing job at highlighting the national Black anthem, you know, the Black flag, and just really highlighting these important historical and community, you know, things that we don't see on a day-to-day basis at our schools, you know, in our communities. So for me, this was an education, and that's what they want to instill in the younger kids. I feel like they really just want to remind them that where they come from and what their history is.
Yeah. And I know that you've also photographed some of these cowboys and girls at the Black Lives Matter protest, including one photo of cowgirl Brianna Noble standing in front of her horse in front of a graffiti covered park in downtown Oakland. Why was she out there? And like, what was she hoping to say with that picture?
So that picture I actually photographed on assignment last year, and I chose Defemery Park in Oakland because it's a historical park where the Black community has gathered for political events. A lot of the Black Panthers gathered there. So it's a very historical park. Her, like, she just attracted so much attention that day that it kind of blew my mind. When the media saw this strong, confident Black woman on a horse, she really like blew their minds. She told me that she didn't really even intend to go to, like, it wasn't even planned that her going to the protest. She just said, you know what, let me see if I can make it down there. And she just went spur of the moment, like last minute. It just kind of changed everything, I felt like.
I remember that. It was definitely impactful. I mean, KK, for you, we're talking about, you know, Black pride, but also I know several of the writers in the book talk about how this kept them out of trouble as teenagers, giving them focus and purpose. For you, what's the impact been?
The impact has been a remarkable impact on me because I am an inner city kid. I'm from West Oakland. You know, in the city, there's really nothing for our younger generation as far as, like, you know, either become a nurse or you go to school and, you know, just become something that everybody participates in, you know, even the men, either football, basketball, gymnastics for girls, you know. And I've tried every sport. I literally tried everything, including modeling, all that. And even when I was younger, I was like, I want to do gymnastics for the rest of my life. And, you know, I got too tall for it. So when I got on the horse, it was just so therapeutic for me as a child. And I told my grandmother, I said, I found my passion, because we've been looking for it for years all my life. And it was just like, it was a remarkable moment for me. It still to this day, it leaves an impact on me. When I get off work, I go straight to my horses. I take care of my priorities, come home, go to sleep, and repeat. So it's like, if I didn't have horses in my life, I don't know. I actually don't know where I would be at this moment. I really don't.
Well, and it sounds like what you're doing also is in having an impact on younger kids. You share a story about 1 year sticking around after the rodeo to let fans ride your horse, and a little girl called you a black princess and told you she wants to be like you when she grows up. Mm-hmm. Is that, I can imagine that's very meaningful, but is that part of the reason you're doing this?
In a sense of a way, yes. I also love the fact that I've left an impact on several young black children. It's like, it warms my heart when that, you know, a child tells you, oh, I've never seen this before, I want to be like you, or you're a black princess. And it's like, wow, you never think of that. Like, especially when you're doing something that I wouldn't say it's like not normal to, you know, just hear a female from Oakland, California to say, oh, I'm a barrel racer and I ride horses. And then they're like, what do you do? You know? So it's, yeah. Yeah, I was saying that in a sense it does.
Yeah. Gabby, you know, you've put this all out into the world on a bigger platform. What do you hope people take away from this book?
I think for me, it's really about taking a deeper look at our history. I hope this is just like a teaser for people to learn about Black culture, Black history, and especially Black cowboys. There's so much that's been left behind in history books and school and everything. Just to like always be open to new things and new communities, new people.
Well, thank you both for being here today. Gabriella Haspen is a photographer and author of The New Black West, Photographs from America's Only Touring Black Rodeo. KK Brinson is a black cowgirl. She'll be competing this weekend in the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo. That's happening at the Industry Hills Expo Center in the City of Industry on Saturday and Sunday. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's movie season, and our critics have some choice words for one of this summer's action flicks.
It's brown and hazy the entire time. I don't know why these people can't turn a light on. I wish it looked better.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand. Well, it's been another long week, and we could all use a good movie right about now. So it's time for our weekend film reviews. Joining us is Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Services and the Los Angeles Times. Hey, Katie.
Hi, Marisa.
Carlos Aguilar is also here. He writes for the LA Times and the AV Club. Hey, Carlos.
Hi, Marisa. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so excited to go over quite a range of films we have today. First up is the film adaptation of Where the Crawdads Sing. It's based on the best-selling novel by Delia Owens. Here's a clip.
I have, like you, heard the tall tales told about the Marsh Girl. An abandoned child.
I had a family once. They called me Kyle.
A little girl surviving in the marsh on her own, reviled and shunned.
Hello, Miss Kyle.
I hear y'all by muscles.
All right, Katie, this film was produced by Reese Witherspoon. It's starring Daisy Edgar-Jones as Kaya. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just read this book, and I don't know that the film really gets the adaptation right. It kind of feels like it's a little bit rushed. There's a story that takes place over, you know, several decades about this girl who's been growing up abandoned in the North Carolina marsh, and she stands trial for a murder of a former lover. So it has kind of this Southern Gothic courtroom drama thing going on as we're flashing back in time to her childhood. But I just don't think they really spend enough time with this character to really understand who she is. It kind of feels like everybody is like rushing through the plot points and just hitting their marks and moving on. So it almost gets to the point where you're like, I don't really understand her. She's kind of, you know, she seems a little bit silly. So, you know, I really wanted to like this, but it just didn't really work for me.
Well, Carlos, this was one of the best-selling books ever written. I read it. To Katie's point, as a book, it was a really sort of beautiful exploration, very slow moving in some ways, and a lot about nature, not just about the people, but sort of nature as a character. What did you think of this as a film?
I have not read the novel, and I'm not sure the movie makes me particularly interested in doing so. I thought the movie was really so poor and terrible on all fronts, particularly the acting. There are mentions of nature. I think that there are moments in which they try to sort of like correlate Kaya's journey to, you know, the fact that nature has no moral values, that nature doesn't know what's right or wrong, that nature is only there to survive. So I feel like they tried to bring that in. But to me, the real problem is just how sort of like corny and trite the dialogue feels. The heartbreak scenes are played out so long to try to evoke some emotion out of the audience, and just like they fall flat. I don't know. I feel like this movie really was banking on the fact that so many people read this book, and so the fan base is there, and they did the very minimum in this adaptation. And I feel bad because I think Daisy Edgar Jones and even Harris Dickinson are usually really great in other things. You know, Daisy Edgar Jones was in the show Normal People, and Harris Dickinson has been in Beach Rats and other films. So I think they're really great actors that are trapped in the bad dialogue and sort of like hackneyed acting here.
All right, not a resounding endorsement from our critics, but if you still want to go see it, Where the Crawdads Sing is in wide release today. All right, next up is a new comedy drama that takes place in 1950s London. It's called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris.
Excuse me, dear. I'm after a frock, one of them £500 ones.
You have the wrong address.
Please, let me escort you out.
No, hang on a minute. I've saved every penny scrubbing floors so I can buy this frock.
Excuse me, but it would be my honor to have you view the collection as my guest.
All right, Carlos, so Leslie Manville plays Mrs. Harris. She's a house cleaner who dreams of wearing Dior. What else is this film about?
Well, the film is about, you know, her dream of going to Paris and getting this dress, but also about sort of like, you know, fixing people's lives and at the end fixing her own. She's a widow, and she sort of like, you know, live her life for others. And now she's, you know, finally decided that she's going to make this happen for herself. She gets a few sort of lucky breaks that allow her to make this happen. And once she gets to Paris, everyone falls in love with her. She's sort of like quaint and, you know, speaks her mind. And so, you know, we see her interact with all the characters. You know, there's a young couple in the film that she's sort of playing matchmaker for. French legend Isabelle Huppert is in the film as, you know, almost playing the character that Leslie Manville plays in Phantom Thread, you know, which I thought it was very interesting. You know, the both movies about high fashion. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very sort of, you know, life-affirming, you know, lovely film that occasionally I think it tries to talk about workers' rights. There's a moment in which, you know, someone tells Mrs. Harris that in Paris, the worker is king. And, you know, she sees that there's workers striking, and sort of like she gets this sense of like the power of the worker and how, you know, she's being mistreated back home, and, you know, kind of changes her worldview that way. So that was, you know, enjoyable, lovely in a memorable way, even if we've seen this kind of movie before.
Yeah. Katie, what do you think? I mean, from the previews, it seems like a very sort of upbeat kind of take on all of this.
Oh, absolutely. I loved this. It's just such a nice moment of escapism. If you can't actually go to Paris this summer, why don't you go with Leslie Manville? You know, it's just a really frothy, fantastical fashion movie. Totally the movie that I would watch with my mom or, you know, any friends like that. It kind of sits at the intersection of Phantom Thread, as Carlos mentioned, and Emily in Paris. I will say there are some, you know, narrative DNA that is shared between this film and Emily in Paris, and the way in which an outsider goes to this city and sort of charms everyone with their you know, different kind of ways of thinking and being in the world. But I think this movie really works because of Leslie Manville and her really beautiful, luminous performance at the center of this. You know, the plot is far-fetched and fanciful, but, you know, and it's very predictable. There are these certain beats where you're going, okay, I think that this is going to happen next and these two are going to get together. And, but it's really enjoyable. And, I found this to be like a really delightful, you know, summer breeze of a movie.
I was going to say, good vacation film. And was there any overlap between actors between that and Emily in Paris? I thought I might have.
Yes.
That. Yeah.
Lucas Bravo, who plays the hunky chef on Emily in Paris.
Okay, that's what I thought.
He plays the accountant for the House of Dior. And she, you know, Mrs. Harris kind of sets him up with someone. And it's a really fun little overlap, you know, seeing Leslie Manville, you know, her role in Phantom Thread is very similar to the Isabelle Huppert role here. And then Lucas Bravo, you know, showing up in Paris once again. So that was really fun.
All right, a fun movie. Let's move on. Well, we should say Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris is in wide release today, so you can check it out. And now, Carlos, we have a Croatian film called Marina. It was a big winner at the Cannes Film Festival last year, and it was filmed on an island off the coast of Croatia. Let's hear a bit of the trailer.
Julia, get up. Get up and recite the poem I wrote you. I wrote that poem for you.
Sjedim na obali I gledam u tem. Gledam u daljinu gde se s nebom spaja.
So that's the main character, Julia. She's 17 years old, and her domineering father's asking her to read his poem at a party. You heard her reciting, "I sit on the coast looking for you, looking into the distance where you become the sky." Carlos, it seems like a lot of this film was actually filmed underwater. What is it about?
So Julia is a teenager who lives, you know, with her parents on this island. And the story begins as they're getting ready to welcome a guest, Javier, who is her father's friend, a wealthy friend, who they want to convince to buy this land. And so the father, who's sort of a very patriarchal, you know, violent figure in this family, but Julia is sort of like a free spirit. And, you know, in meeting Javier, she gets ideas of a bigger world. You know, she starts thinking that she could probably live with him and go away to start alive on her own away from her father. And the mother plays a very submissive part in the film to sort of like show Julia what she doesn't want to become. It's a movie that plays, you know, in this very beachy, sunlit, summery spaces. But underneath that, there's a lot of sort of like tension and drama in the family that goes unspoken, but the tension's there. There's underwater sequences because both Julia and her father, they swim to try to catch the moray eel. That's sort of hard to catch, and an animal that will bite itself to free itself from being caught. So sort of like trying to make, you know, that sort of link between Julia going against the family at all costs. I think it's a very striking debut. The performances are really great in this one from, you know, the young actress who plays Julia. You know, we've seen so many coming of age stories, but this one really has a unique sort of vibe, not only because of the location and because it's Croatia, but because of how the dynamics are played between this family and the newcomer, Javier, who sort of like acts as a catalyst for Julia to seek freedom.
Great. You can see Marina at the Lemley Monica Film Center starting Friday. Now, switching gears entirely, a new action film on Netflix. It's called The Gray Man, and it's directed by the Russo brothers. It stars Ryan Gosling and Chris Evans. Let's take a listen.
What do you know about the Sierra program?
Ready?
reckless mystery man you guys send in when you can't officially send anyone else?
The Gray Man.
Lloyd. I got an urgent locate and destroy.
That could be fun. The man's got some street cred.
Carlos, this sounds like a lot of action. What is this all about?
So this one's about Ryan Gosling playing a CIA agent, a part of this elite group of former and incarcerated criminals who are given a chance to be free with the caveat that they have to work for the CIA and become sort of this, you know, unseen and shadowy figures to commit, you know, assassinations and whatnot. And so we follow him as he discovers that the program is being sort of terminated and that he's probably going to get killed next. And it's, you know, it's a bunch of action throughout the 2 hours of running time. I found it, you know, entertaining enough that I was sort of like not paying attention to the running time, which I think is always a good thing with an action movie that has, you know, big stars and expands so many countries and, you know, things are blowing up. I don't think it has a lot to say, even though it tries to make a case for why, you know, Ryan Gosling's character is the way he is. So it tries to like give a little bit of emotional sort of depth to it, but really it's mostly about the fights and the explosions. And I found it more enjoyable than I thought I would, even if it's sort of like empty, you know, summer fun.
Blockbuster. Yeah, Katie, I mean, Ryan Gosling and Chris Evans, it can't be that bad, right?
It is nice to see Ryan Gosling back in action. You know, he's taken a break for a little while, and until we get to see him as Ken, we will have to settle for him as Six. You know, I thought this was just an okay average action film. It's brown and hazy the entire time. I don't know why these people can't turn a light on. I just, I wish it looked better. The action's okay. You know, Chris Evans is clearly having a whole lot of fun as this character named Lloyd, who is a mustachioed, driving shoe wearing, polo shirt wearing villain. I almost want to see the Lloyd prequel. I was more interested in him. Where did he come from? But yeah, it's okay. I wouldn't say it is all that great. But, you know, it's in theaters this weekend and it's going to be on Netflix next week. So, you know, if you throw it on Netflix when it comes out, it's a sort of average action movie.
Okay, last but not least, Katie, a movie for kids. This is Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank. Let's listen in.
Why do you want to be a samurai?
I lived in a bad part of town full of bad dogs. Everybody always picked on me. I thought if I could be a samurai, it would change everything.
Sounds like you need a mentor.
Perhaps a once great samurai who has fallen on hard times and maybe could use some help himself. But where could I find one?
Katie, so Hank is a beagle who aspires to be a samurai. He's voiced by Michael Cera. Jimbo is an old cat who trains him. You can probably tell, voiced by Samuel L. Jackson. I will say my 6-year-old, who's usually a little movie-averse, thought this trailer was very funny. What did you think? Will kids be into this?
Yeah, kids will definitely be into this. And you know what? Parents who are movie nerds will also be into this, because Paws of Fury is a riff on the classic Mel Brooks comedy Blazing Saddles. It basically lifts that plot and transplants it to this Japanese village that is entirely populated by cats, and they need a new samurai to come and protect them. And it's this dog played by Michael Cera, who's trained by Jimbo. So there are a lot of movie references in this film. There's like a West Side Story reference. There's a lot of references to classic Kurosawa films. And Mel Brooks himself actually offers a voice. He plays the Shogun. So I thought this movie was really fun. It's super clever. It's very self-reflective. The kids will really enjoy the sort of absurdist action-y humor. It's got a very Looney Tunes almost sensibility. It's not super deep, but it doesn't have to be super deep. Right. It's about the legend of Hank. So it's just like a very surfacey kind of movie. I think you could do a lot worse in terms of kids' movies. But I really enjoyed this. I thought it was fun. So I think that it'll be a good time for both parents and kids.
All right. The Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank is in wide release today. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Services and the LA Times. And Carlos Aguilar also reviews films for the LA Times and the AV Club. Coming up, the Dodgers have had the best record in the National League so far, and LA's gearing up to host the MLB All-Star Game. The Sklar brothers are here to talk sports. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos, pinch hitting for Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
We're at the midpoint of the baseball season, and the Dodgers have had the best record in the National League. Good news for Dodgers fans. And Dodgers Stadium will host the All-Star Game next week, which might not be so good if the stadium employees go on strike. Plus, Bruin and Trojans fans rejoice. Your schools are joining the Big Ten. Ten as in the brisk winter temperatures their new division opponents are used to playing in. Randy and Jason Sklar, Los Hermanos Sklar, are with us to discuss all of this. They also host the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Hey, guys.
Hey there. How are you?
We're good.
Good. Good to be here with you. All right. So the Dodgers are in first place, and yep. I wouldn't call that a surprise. The season has gone about as well as expected, but why do you think they're doing so well?
So the Dodgers have this unbelievable mix and the alchemy of bringing in great free agents who have been amazing elsewhere. You look at a guy like Freddie Freeman, who plays first base for them. He was amazing with the Atlanta Braves, helped them to win a World Series.
Trey Turner
is incredible, came from elsewhere. And then you've got like this, and Mookie Betts, who came from Boston. So they have guys who have been there and been to the mountaintop before. And then they have great young players that they sort of have produced through their farm system, like a Tony Gonsolin starting pitcher who is 11-0 right now. So they're just getting production from everyone. It's an organization that is humming on all cylinders.
Well, speaking of pitchers, Clayton Kershaw drank from the fountain of youth, it seems. He's an all-star this year, which is a surprise given last postseason he wasn't even playing and people thought his career was basically, if not over, sinking. What has it been like to watch him have this career rejuvenation?
Well, it's huge for him because he's such an icon. When you think about the history of pitching with the Dodger organization, he reminds us, Randy and I both, of Sandy Koufax, a left-handed pitcher who was super dominant for a 10-year span. And yeah, it did kind of seem like, you know, with some of his postseason hiccups that he's had in his career, that's sort of been the only black mark on his record. But now he's 6-2 in this season. He's back. He's got an under 3 ERA, earned run average. So he's really doing well. And he's getting close to 200 wins in his career, 3,000 strikeouts in his career. Randy and I both believe that he will be a first ballot Hall of Famer and one of the go down in history as one of the best pitchers in Dodgers history. So he's also a fan favorite. So for him to be having a resurgence right now in LA with the All-Star game coming to LA. They haven't named starting pitchers yet for the game, but it could be him, and that would be a huge moment and a huge feather in the cap of just a Hall of Fame career.
All right, look at you're making some predictions here. We might hold you
to
them.
Please.
Well,
do.
as we mentioned, Dodger Stadium workers are actually threatened to strike this week, which I imagine is a terrifying prospect given how many events and contests and games there are around All-Star week. Assuming that doesn't happen, though, are you guys excited?
Yeah, very excited. I mean, it's great to have an All-Star game in the city. The fanfare is exciting. I think, you know, it's funny because Jay and I came to Los Angeles 23 years ago. And at a time when I think Dodger Stadium was looked at, they were building all these new stadiums that looked like old ballparks. And you kind of looked at Dodger Stadium, you thought, I don't know, is this a beautiful ballpark? But over time, and with improvements that have been made to the ballpark, It is now, I believe, the third oldest ballpark, if I'm correct. There's Wrigley Field, there's Fenway Park, but it is like a classic ballpark. And I think what the entire Major League Baseball fandom will see is just what a beautiful ballpark, you know, it really is. So it's exciting. You know, the workers are back at the negotiating table, and hopefully they can get a deal done, because but
kudos to them for taking this opportunity to raise whatever concerns they have. I don't know if you've bought a beer at Dodger Stadium, but it's about $23. And I think the workers probably should get a little bit more than what they're getting in that situation.
But is it a good beer for $23, I guess, is the other question.
I think a Michelob Ultra, you can decide.
We'll leave that there.
Sure.
All right.
Not sure.
So what are y'all expecting for the second half of the season into the playoffs? Can they keep this up?
Well, so it's always exciting when teams like the Dodgers are a big market team like the Dodgers are doing well. And also on the other side, on the American League, the Yankees are playing out of their minds. They have the best record in baseball, 62 wins so far. The Dodgers are at 57. But those are like the best team in the American League, the best team in the National League. The Dodgers and the Yankees, those are classic matchups, 1977 World Series, 1981 World Series. You know, the back and forth between those teams, that would be an incredible World Series. And, you know, Houston is good. There's a huge rivalry between Houston and the Dodgers. That could be an interesting World Series. So a lot of the familiar players and the familiar teams the last few years that have been good are good again. So, but I see the Dodgers in it almost, if not all the way to the end. So look for a great run. Like LA sports fans and Dodgers fans, you have a lot to look forward to in the second half of the year. Plus, there are a lot of Dodger players that were injured that are coming back. So you're going to see a lot of the reinforcements are coming back by August, I think.
All right, well, let's switch gears for the end of the segment. Let's talk about UCLA and USC leaving the Pac-12 for the Big Ten, a conference you two are very familiar with as Michigan grads.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happened here? Why does it matter to somebody who may not follow football as college ball as, you know, closely as you do?
So college football is steeped in tradition, and there were five Power Five conferences. There was the Pac-10, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the SEC, and the ACC. And the SEC a year ago basically raided the Big 12 and took their two best teams, Oklahoma and Texas. They're coming to the SEC. And essentially that rendered that conference pretty impotent at this moment. And the Big 10, looking ahead, their only sort of move to make their conference as relevant as the SEC was to raid the Pac-12. So they took the two most marketable, the two most recognizable brands, UCLA and USC, and they brought them into the Big Ten. Now, why is that significant? Well, it's significant for media market share. They have New York with teams like Rutgers. They have DC with a team like Maryland. They have Chicago with teams like Northwestern. And now they're going to have Los Angeles with two of the biggest names in college football. And you mentioned football, but there's also basketball. Obviously, UCLA has one of the greatest basketball traditions ever. USC, not a bad school. But let's talk about the other sports. How about gymnastics? UCLA is unbelievable. How about swimming and diving? USC has just been off the charts. Softball, you know, baseball, UCLA is just incredible in both of those. So you have a number of NCAA champions and former Olympic champions that come from those schools. It's going to raise the level all the way across the board on all sports in the Big Ten.
And it allows people like us who are Michigan fans, who are transplants out here in Los Angeles, to possibly see Michigan play USC or play UCLA.
In a regular season game. It's not, you know, the weird thing about it is geography, because we always thought of the Big Ten as like schools like Indiana and Iowa and Illinois and Michigan State and Wisconsin. They're all in the same area. Geographically now, it's coast to coast.
But what does that mean for the Pac-12?
I mean, the Pac-12 has just been ripped to shreds. And so people are thinking, well, maybe the next two dominoes to fall and leave the Pac-12 will be Oregon and Washington.
So if those go to the Big Ten, what you may start to see and what it's foreshadowing is like two giant
mega conferences,
the SEC in the South and somewhat of the Big Ten across the North with a little bit of this smattering on the West Coast. You know, I think the schools themselves, UCLA being a good academic institution and same with USC, they fit the bill as far as academics and scholarship that goes. So it does feel, the only thing that's weird is geography and the tradition. So once people get over that, which I think they'll have to, then it's going to be two super conferences down the road.
All right. The Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason, their podcast is View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
That does does it for this week on Press Play. All next week, we've cooked up something special for you, our second annual summer mixtape, a mix of some of the great music content you hear on Press Play and across KCRW's music programming. Starting on Monday with Madeline's conversation with singer, songwriter, and pianist Regina Spector. Plus, we'll have a DJ set from KCRW DJ Wildflower. It's Press Play's summer mixtape. Our producers are Brian Hardinsky, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Marcel Hutchins, Nihar Patel, and Robin Estrin. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Taw is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical director is Mario Saavedra. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening this week. I'll see you soon.